From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, today launched a thinly veiled attack on China. Speaking in Germany, Bernanke criticized countries that he said keep their currency rates artificially low. He also defended some of the moves the Fed has taken to stimulate growth in the U.S. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The Fed chairmen are usually on a kind of a pedestal. They're slow to answer criticism, and they try hard to stay above politics. But today, Bernanke made some unusually pointed remarks about countries that keep their currency rates artificially low as a way of promoting exports.
Differences in the degree of currency flexibility impose unequal burdens of adjustment, penalizing countries with relatively flexible exchange rates.
In other words, countries that manipulate their currency to keep their factories humming and make their exports cheaper build up huge trade surpluses. That causes big imbalances and undermines growth around the world. Bernanke never mentioned China, but it was clearly the prime target of his wrath. The remarks come at a time when China and other countries have criticized the Fed over its policy of quantitative easing. That's a method of pouring money into the economy by buying up long-term treasury bills. Critics have complained that the policy is a kind of a backdoor attempt by the United States to weaken its currency. Bernanke said it's other countries that are manipulating their currency, and they need to stop. They should let the markets decide how much their currency is worth.
Sun Won Son is a professor of economics and finance at California State University.
Chairman Bernanke basically saying that, you know, let the market decide. And again, if you're living in a glass house, you shouldn't throw stones.
Bernanke went on to defend some of the Fed's recent moves. He said by making money so cheap and available, the Fed is just trying to jolt the U.S. economy back to life and bring down the stubbornly high unemployment rate. And because the U.S. remains such a big part of the world economy, solving its problems will be good for everybody. There was no immediate response from China. Jim Zeroli, NPR News.
Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar travels to Houma, Louisiana today. He'll be meeting with oil industry executives who are not especially happy. Even though the Obama administration has lifted its moratorium on drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, the government has been slow to issue drilling permits. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
It's not the big oil companies hurting now. The Gulf of Mexico is just one sliver of their worldwide portfolios. It's the smaller companies who rely more heavily on the Gulf. Among them is Hercules Offshore. About 25 miles from the Texas coast is the Hercules 205 shallow water drilling rig. Getting there requires an hour-long boat ride with a friendly skipper who likes his Christmas music. On the huge rig, which is standing in about 100 feet of water, there's no drilling because there are no permits from regulators. Workers are performing maintenance, spraying away rust and old paint. Down below, welders are repairing some steel plating, and work will begin soon to replace showers in the bathroom. In the galley for lunch is assistant driller Bobby Wagasback, who says this is an uncertain time.
Well, if you don't know you're going to have a job the next week, it affects your mind, you know.
These crews typically work and live on the rig for a few weeks, then have a few weeks off. Wagasback says even his home time has become stressful.
You don't know if you're going to get a call and saying, well, you know, we might have to bump you down as a rough spot or roughneck or something, and that would affect your pay.
Or even worse, he could get laid off. Hercules Offshore has lost more than half of its stock market value since BP's Deepwater Horizon accident last April. Jim Noe is a senior vice president, and he heads a coalition of shallow water drillers.
The wells that we're drilling aren't the BP Macondo wells. They're natural gas wells, not oil wells, and we're using technology that we've been using for decades, safely and without incident.
It looked like the Obama administration recognized this, too, at first. The shallow water moratorium lasted less than a month.
And yet, we've been facing what we've called a de facto moratorium because the Obama bureaucrats won't issue permits.
Noe says historically, the government approved 10 to 15 shallow water drilling permits a month. But now, that number has fallen to almost none.
We don't think it's slow enough, actually. We think they should come to a complete stop with permitting offshore drilling.
Jackie Savitz is a senior campaign director with the environmental group Oceana. She says it's clear why regulators are moving so slowly.
We can't afford to cut corners. We can't afford to go easy on safety requirements. Otherwise, we end up losing lives and, creating uncontrollable disasters in our oceans.
But what Savitt sees as taking extra care to protect people and ecosystems, others see as outright hostility from the Obama administration. Randy Stille is CEO of Seahawk Drilling.
Everything they've done since this incident indicates to me that they don't like the oil and gas industry, and this was a good excuse to punish it.
Last week, Louisiana Senator Mary Landrieu agreed to lift her hold on one of President Obama's nominees. In return, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is headed to the Gulf today to get an earful from industry executives.
Knowing Senator Landrieu like I do, I'm sure she believes that she has a commitment. Now let's see if we actually have one and we see some results.
We're headed back to shore now. You can see the drilling rig off in the distance getting smaller behind us. Over on the left, there are three Seahawk drilling rigs clustered very close together. That's unusual to see out here. Essentially, they're mothballed. They're waiting for drilling activity to pick back up in the shallow waters of the Gulf of Mexico. Jeff Brady, NPR News, aboard the Carissa Shane transport boat.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The CEO of the embattled coal mining company, Massey Energy, appealed to a select group of reporters yesterday to turn the spotlight somewhere else. Massey and Don Blankenship have been in the focus of critical reporting since the deadly explosion in April at the company's Upper Big Branch mine in West Virginia. Mr. Blankenship told the assembled reporters to look instead at federal regulators. NPR's Howard Berkus was there.
And so were reporters from The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and local media, all gathered around a dark wooden table in an ornate conference room.
Well, have a seat and make yourself at home unless you want some of those nuts or fruits or whatever.
There was also sweet tea and chocolates for the gathering at Massey's West Virginia headquarters, a half hour south of Charleston. Don Blankenship sat at the head of the table, a mustached man who was both soft-spoken and direct.
I wanted to give you a chance to ask me questions today, and I may even, if it's all right, ask you all some questions to see whether our communication efforts are working.
And for 2.5 hours, the Massey CEO took all kinds of questions about the explosion in April that killed 29 mine workers. Blankenship also repeatedly turned to his main talking points for the day. Number one, don't place blame before the facts are in.
What we're trying to do is actually to avoid the focus on culpability and figure out what happened. The focus ought to be on the physics, the chemistry, the math, the science, to figure out what the source of the explosion was rather than trying to point fingers.
Talking point number two, the official investigation cannot be trusted because the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration is essentially investigating itself. That leads to talking point number three. Federal investigators are not allowing Massey to conduct its own probe in the way Massey's hired experts want. Despite that, there's point number four. Massey has a new theory about the cause, and it essentially leaves the company blameless.
I don't know that anyone could foresee that natural gas coming out of the floor at UBB was going to be ignited and cause an explosion.
Until last week, methane gas was considered the likely fuel for the Upper Big Branch blast. Methane is naturally produced in coal seams, and there are all kinds of things coal mine companies are supposed to do to guard against it. So if the blast was caused by methane, well, it's more likely the company failed in some way. But natural gas seeps in from beneath the coal seam, and that's relatively rare.
Most everything you do is guarded against the things that happen lots of times. The laws and the things that coal miners do every day are more in guarding against coal bed methane than they are an inundation of natural gas.
But natural gas infusions have occurred at Upper Big Branch, and 6 years ago, federal regulators laid out 8 steps to address the problem. Neither Massey nor the Mine Safety Agency will say they actually implemented any of them. Blankenship says he thinks the company decided more ventilation, more airflow in the mine, would sweep away any dangerous gases. That raises questions for Davitt McAteer, who leads an independent team of investigators assembled by West Virginia's former governor.
And I think that's the question, is how did they address that, and what kind of engineering and what kind of factual basis did they use to make a determination that ordinary ventilation would take care of it?
In other words, could Massey have done more? McAteer agrees with Blankenship that culpability comes after the facts are determined, but he believes Massey's conclusions are premature. Blankenship didn't mention McAteer's independent team, but he rejects the work done by federal mine safety investigators. He urged reporters to turn their attention to the Mine Safety Agency and its regulatory practices, which he claims make mines less safe. That was something he said repeatedly.
You know, we hope you leave here with some idea that there's a lot to the story and that we're trying to be transparent and that we find out what happened at UBB and that we can make all the mines at Massey and elsewhere safer, and we appreciate you coming.
And with that, some reporters gathered around the Massey CEO for more questions. A half hour later, the Federal Mine Safety Agency included Massey's Upper Big Branch mine on a list of 14 coal mines with chronic and persistent health and safety problems. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Charleston, West Virginia.
General Motors was back on the New York Stock Exchange this week, less than 18 months after the iconic American car company had to be bailed out by the federal government. GM's initial public offering was one of the largest in Wall Street's history. The company is more efficient and profitable, but there's still plenty of questions about the road ahead. For more, we turn now to Micheline Maynard. She's the senior editor of Changing Gears, a new public radio project that looks at the future of the industrial Middle West. Mickey joins us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Mickey, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Scott.
And the company got off to a pretty good start on Wall Street at least this week, didn't it?
It did. Originally, General Motors stock was supposed to sell somewhere in the mid-$20 range, and there was an enormous amount of interest in it, and it ended up opening at about $33 and going up in the first day of trading, although I think some of those gains moderated by the end of the week.
Does it appear that the corporate restructuring that they underwent worked as planned, and for that matter, the agreements with labor unions and the thinning out of their structure?
General Motors today is a much leaner company than it was a year and a half ago or even 2 years ago. The one thing that consumers would notice, of course, is that General Motors got rid of four of their brands. They no longer have Saab, Hummer, Pontiac, or Saturn. They've gotten rid of several hundred dealers, which is something else that you would notice driving down the street where there's a dealership. And they did close a number of plants and lay off thousands of workers. That's something that's hurt communities across the Midwest, really across the country. So there have been some people who have suffered because of the comeback of General Motors.
What seems to be the new car models that GM is looking to make an impression with?
Well, a couple of them should be on people's radar now. One is called the Chevrolet Cruze, and it's a small car that's built in Youngstown, Ohio, at the Lordstown plant. And it's intended to compete with cars like the Honda Civic and the Toyota Corolla, and it's actually gotten a lot of favorable publicity. It's just now showing up in showrooms. The next vehicle that you'll be hearing a lot about is the Chevrolet Volt, which is a plug-in hybrid electric car that can run on an electric charge or on a small motor. And Toyota is actually the leader in hybrid cars. It's been selling the Prius for about 10 years. Honda has the Insight. There's another electric model called the Nissan Leaf that's getting a lot of attention, too. So, you know, even as General Motors introduces these new cars, they do face a lot of competition.
And what about the company's long-term prospects? Because it's not as if Japanese and German auto manufacturers are standing still. And of course, then there are Indian and Chinese and Brazilian companies coming into the market also.
Exactly. One thing that we don't worry about now, I think, is that General Motors might collapse or dissolve. They basically got a new lease on life from what the Obama administration did for them. I think their long-term prospects are good as long as they don't lose sight of the fact of what you just said. This is a very competitive market. Nobody is standing still. You know, but there are no guarantees in the car market. Chrysler also got a federal bailout. They're now under the control of Fiat, and everybody is kind of waiting to see if they'll catch fire because they haven't started selling stock again. It's not clear whether they will. They've been cutting dealerships and laying people off. They say they've got a turnaround in the works, too, but they are a little bit farther behind than General Motors. So really, the two competitors in the American companies are General Motors and Ford.
Mickey, what does the survival and restructuring of GM conceivably mean to the industrial Middle West?
Well, General Motors has been the most important company in the country for most of its 100 or so year history. in the Midwest, it was really the company that mattered. People called it Generous Motors. They called it Mother Motors. The idea was that you would go to work there, work your way up the system, and have a nice retirement afterwards. When General Motors started to fall on hard times, it affected everyone in this region, from Janesville, Wisconsin, over to Pittsburgh. It really was a company that buoyed the whole Midwest economy. So the fact that General Motors has been restructured, the fact that the General Motors building is now the Renaissance Center in Detroit, but it's still there, is a great inspiration to a lot of people in the Midwest region. And its future health is something that a lot of people are counting on.
Micheline Maynard, senior editor of a public radio project called Changing Gears, speaking with us from Chicago. Mickey, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Scott.